We have one case for submission at 1:30. Appears that everybody's here. The panel that will be hearing this will be to my left, the Honorable Brian Walker. Second oral argument on the bench.
Are you going to do that every time?
I'm going to do it every time now. As long as I'm head of panel, I'm going to harass you. Anyway, to my right is Justice Mike Wallach, and I am Justice Wade Birdwell. So we've had an opportunity to look at the briefs, and we will go ahead now, and if the clerk will announce the case.
May it please the court.
Sure.
Greg Gober here for Texas Health Harris Methodist Hospital, Fort Worth, and I want to put this case in context a little bit before we start talking about the facts and the law, but this is a hospital lien case, and these kind of cases are becoming more and more common. We're seeing them brought by plaintiffs who want the lien reduced. We're seeing them brought by defendants who see the hospital lien statute as a means of kind of litigating the reasonableness of the charges in the trial court, so they'll bring the hospital in. And we're seeing the use of the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act to litigate these hospital lien cases because the Declaratory Judgment Act will give the plaintiff its attorney's fees. And that's one of our primary arguments in the case, is that's an inappropriate use of the Declaratory Judgment Act.
Well, counsel, you have distinguished Garner on the grounds that the lien in question there actually stated $841 and change as the amount of the lien. Why is that a key distinction that we should use here, as opposed to, since the entirety of that opinion was dealing with the issue of whether or not asking for a full invalidation or cancellation, as it used the term in the opinion, whether that included also a partial cancellation of the lien. Why does putting the number in the lien, the amount in the lien, allow that type of deck action, but if the number's not in the lien here, it doesn't allow a deck action?
Well, under Section 55.005, the hospital lien statute states what needs to be in a lien for it to be valid. And it lists the things that need to be in there. All of those things are in our lien. The lien does not require, or the statute does not require, that the lien state an amount. The amount is open to interpretation. The parties, as the court in Bashara said, can go litigate that. They can negotiate that. They can figure it out, you know, on their own.
What's the vehicle by which a patient would challenge the amount of the lien if it's not through the deck action?
Well, I think in this case, that's what he did. He challenged.
No, I'm asking you, if the deck action is not available, which is what you're arguing, okay, then, and Bashara and subsequent Supreme Court authority says categorically that, subject to a determination of reasonableness, okay, it's enforceable, okay. How does a patient challenge the lien that's on the books in the county?
I think the patient brings a cause of action under Chapter 55. I think that's what the patient in Garner did, and I think that's what Mr. Featherly did. Chapter 37 does not appear in his petition. The only statute that appears in his petition is Chapter 55 of the Property Code. Chapter 37, Civil Practice Remedies Code, 37.03, 37.04, 37.07, 09, are not referenced anywhere in the petition. It says a declaratory judgment under Chapter 55 of the Property Code. And if you look at the Garner case does not reference the Declaratory Judgment Act, which was enacted back, as far as I can tell, back in 1943. So it was available to the plaintiff in the Garner case, but the Garner case does not mention that it's brought under the Declaratory Judgment Act. So I think the patient can bring a claim under Chapter 55, just like the hospital could intervene in a lawsuit, which there are cases on that. Hospitals have intervened in lawsuits and said, we're going to assert our lien.
What language in Chapter 55 authorizes a patient to bring an action?
There is no specific authorization.
Well, there's no specific authorization by the same token under the Declaratory Judgment Act. The Declaratory Judgment Act says if you're affected by a statute, you have standing to bring an action under the Declaratory Judgment Act, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, and it says for the interpretation of the statute, and like the court, this court did in a prior case involving Harris Methodist Fort Worth. The case involved the Medicare Secondary Payer Act and the Prompt Payment Act under the Texas Health Code, and the interplay of those, and the court found that. The court construed the statutes and said, you know, there's preemption, and so Medicare Secondary Payer Act controls, and therefore, you know, this doesn't work. And so it, and then in that case, it did award the hospital its attorney's fees. That's a totally that's an appropriate use of the Declaratory Judgment Act, because you're getting the court to construe a statute, and you're asking the court to determine, you know, the interplay of the two statutes. Here, all we have is a fact question. And the jury's answer is self-effectuating. I mean, the court doesn't really need to interpret or construe anything. The court could recite what the jury's answer was in the charge, put it in the judgment, and you're done. And there's nothing to construe. The jury's answered your question.
Well, hadn't the Supreme Court basically said we don't really know whether or not there's an actual cause of action under Chapter 55, because they were cited to that language in Borders, but then they kind of disassociated themselves from Borders. I'm going blank on the name of the case off the top of my head.
There's a McAllen Hospital case.
Right.
I can't remember the name of the second party, but a McAllen Hospital case, and in that case, the hospital brought a claim against the insurer for the tortfeasor. And if you read the court specific, first of all, it's dicta, but second of all, the court specifically restricts that holding to a claim against a third party. I mean, we have two parties to a lien. The parties to the lien are the patient and the hospital. In that case, it was a third party that the court was talking about in the McAllen case, and that was the insurance company or the insured for the insurance company. That was the tortfeasor. And what the court said basically in that case is we question whether a hospital can come in and have a cause of action against this third party.
Okay.
So
has there been any case law interpreting Chapter 55 that says when there is a challenge, okay, and the burden shifts back to the hospital to prove reasonable and regular rates, okay, what that cause of action is? You've brought a breach of contract, you've brought a quantum merit, but I'm not aware of any of the case law that actually said that's what you actually have to prove with regard, you have to actually prove the elements of a cause of action. Because the statute basically says this is your interest in this particular cause of action.
Well, in this case, the only issue with respect to the lien was the reasonable or regular rate. That was the only issue that was challenged. There's an issue that was brought up later over whether he was admitted to the hospital, but that was never pled, never proved, never raised until after the trial had ended.
Why should we not just simply interpret this to be, instead of a separate and distinct cause of action, okay, it's just a Chapter 55, who owes what under Chapter 55 cause of action. It can be brought as a challenge to cancel all or part of a lien, and it can be brought as a means of enforcement of the lien under the chapter. And in neither case are attorney's fees awardable because it's not provided for in the chapter. In other words, there's nothing in the chapter that actually says the hospital has to prove its lien based upon separate and distinct causes of action.
Correct.
Okay. But there's also nothing that specifically says that the patient has to bring a separate and distinct cause of action under the DEC action with regard to that to be able to challenge the reasonableness, because that's still ultimately the burden of the hospital with regard to the reasonableness of the lien.
Correct. I mean, both parties' substantive rights fall under this statute. They don't come from anywhere else. The parties' substantive rights come from that statute. And if you're, I think people use Declaratory Judgment Act as a crutch in a lot of cases when they don't really need to, and all they're trying to do is enforce their right. For example, there's the...
It's used quite often when the legislature hasn't figured out what they need to do about something and they didn't put it in
the
statute.
When you say the party's substantive rights strictly fall under Chapter 55, that's not entirely true. The hospital could seek to recover for the amount of its bill on a breach of contract or a quantum merit theory totally independent of Chapter 55.
We could, but you have all three. You have a cause of action for breach of contract, you have a cause of action for quantum merit, and you have a cause of action for the lien, and they're all three separate and distinct, and they don't depend on, well, the quantum merit depends on whether or not you have a contract, but the lien doesn't depend on either of the other causes of action. And I wanted to refer the court to a couple of cases. There was the Eaton Industries versus Lehman case, 359 Southwest 3rd, 620. The claim was brought kind of, like I mentioned, as a crutch, used the Declaratory Judgment Act. Well, in that case, they said there was a violation of the Texas Water Code. Some water was diverted and you know, somebody's property was damaged, and so they sought a declaratory judgment. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. You can't. Your cause of action under the Water Code doesn't give you attorney's fees, and you can't use the Declaratory Judgment Act to get there. And then in this court, in a case that was decided just last July, there's a case by the name of Raym, R-A-Y-M, versus Tupelo Management out of Hood County. And in the Raym case, this court said that the Declaratory Judgment Act was a proper vehicle to determine a purchase money resulting trust. In other words, you could ask for a declaratory judgment to declare that you had given someone money to buy the land, but it was going to be titled in the other person's name, and you could use the Declaratory Judgment Act as a vehicle to determine that. However, since you couldn't get your attorney's fees under that equitable cause of action for a purchase money resulting trust, then you can't use the Declaratory Judgment Act to do that. You can file a declaratory judgment case, but you can't get your fees under 3709 because the substantive law that you're bringing your claim under does not provide you that. That was opinion was issued shortly after, I think, our original oral argument, and this was canceled last June, but the opinion was issued July 9th, 2020, and I just discovered that getting ready for the argument today.
Mr. Gilbert, got a question. we have several cases today that we're working on, and it's easy for me to get things confused. Am I right in thinking that attorney's fees were not pled? Is that correct? And before you answer that, and if they were not pled, is your position then that because you say that the Declaratory Judgment Act should not apply, then therefore, because they weren't pled, they're not entitled to them? Is that correct?
No, the attorney's fees were pled, I believe, just in the prayer. But the prayer did not refer to Civil Practice and Remedies Code 37.09 or any statute giving them substantive right for the attorney's fees. It just asked for the attorney's fees.
Is it any and all attorney's fees language, kind of catch-all language?
It was a catch-all type
term. That wasn't specially accepted to, though, correct?
It's a good question. I think I did.
Was it ruled?
I don't think that.
Was it ruled?
I don't think the court signed my order.
Okay. Quick question. You challenged the equitableness and fairness of the attorney's fees awarded to the plaintiff. You don't give us any criteria in your brief about what we should look to determine whether or not attorney's fees in this case are not equitable or equitable or fair. Since that's an abuse of discretion standard for us to decide, what factors should we look to make that determination?
Well, I think I cited two things. One, I think the judgment that was in favor of the plaintiff was entered in error because the plaintiff pled a specific amount as the reasonable and necessary. And second of all, the plaintiff sought a judgment to invalidate the lien. The lien's not invalid. Everything about the lien is valid.
Okay, so
space.
Well, let me ask you real quick. I'm interrupting again, but part of the argument is that there was no admission here, and therefore the lien was invalid. Was actually pled in the original petition for declaratory relief?
There was no.
I'm
admission.
Going believe.
Oh, that was not pled. Now, the only the okay. reasonable and regular rate was pled.
Okay.
And our argument on the attorney's fees, the just and equitable, is that the plaintiff didn't really prevail, for one thing. And if the plaintiff doesn't prevail and shouldn't have a judgment entered, then you send back for a remand.
But you don't have to be the prevailing party to recover attorney's fees.
You don't, but all the court cases that we cited in our brief say you ought to take that into account, who actually prevailed and who didn't, to what extent they prevailed. And then also we cited some cases where basically saying if the lawsuit is essentially attorney-driven, you need to take that into account in the just and equitable. And Mr. Featherly testified at trial. He got all the money he ever wanted out of his lawsuit. He got $200,000 out of a $500,000 settlement. He was pleased with that. He didn't want anything other than that.
All right. Thank,
thank you,
counsel. Would you add a minute to him, please?
Good afternoon. Nice to see the court again. Good to be here today. And I know I'm getting old when I see all the names on the plaque every time I walk in here keep changing. Having sat over there many, many years ago, I understand the difference. Justice Walker, first, the petition was called an original petition for declaratory judgment. They pled for attorney's fees. There were no special exceptions. This was pled, litigated, motions for summary judgment, trial, jury issues, all submitted on the deck action, fought, post-trial, post-judgment motions, all fought on the deck action. I don't think any of this issue was any question at any time that this was a request for a declaratory judgment with regard to the validity of the lien. Second, and until this oral argument, I don't think I ever heard that Chapter 55 was the enabling statute to provide a private cause of action for the person. I've not seen any cases. There's certainly not any language in the statute that provides for such. I was waiting for that. It was what we briefed down below. It was what we briefed even before the court here today was what was Mr. Featherly supposed to do? He retained counsel. There were dialogues about getting the lien issue resolved. And when no action was done by the hospital, what alternative does a litigant have to do other than file a deck action, which Justice Judge Rabel said was exactly the act you would do. It's exactly what I would think you would do, is you'd file a deck action. Chapter 37 specifically provides for writings, other writings, contracts, and statutory rights in relationships between individuals and parties. That's exactly what we have here. We have a lien, which is a writing by another party. It's statutorily authorized under the property code. I can't think of something more on all fours on what you would file coming to somebody trying to do to try to get a resolution.
There are a couple of cases out of Tyler that neither side has cited to us that I found last night. One is Pregen, and the other is Berry, dealing with East Texas Medical Center, which has some kind of weird new name now, okay?
I understand.
And they're Citizens Participation Act cases.
I saw those as well, yes, Your Honor.
And so the funky thing about it is that what the way the Tyler Court referred to the deck action, which is virtually identical to what you've pled, okay, was a deck action to interpret Chapter 55 with regard to whether or not reasonable and regular rates applied as a qualification to charges that were owed. And that was subject to a deck action. Therefore, the deck action was permissible, but it was with regard to the interpretation of the statute, and they kind of left open the question about whether or not the deck action could extend to the actual amounts in controversy. Okay?
Any
idea as to why Tyler's making a distinction about interpreting the statute, but it doesn't actually address the amounts, or they're at least saying we don't have to get there?
You know, the way I read the Berry opinion was also it dealt with the Citizens Participation Act and whether it was a free speech issue as well, and that the deck action could be possibly viewed as the hospitals was their free speech act, the deck action response.
And the commercial exception,
correct,
et cetera.
Correct, exactly. I didn't read it as that, other than maybe wanting not to hit it straight up, given that they had the complexity of, I think, the overlay of the Citizens Participation Act.
Well, they still, on the second tier, they still had to come up with, you know, clear and specific evidence of a cause of action, and therefore Tyler said, here's what your cause of action is, which is the interpretation of the statute.
Yeah, I mean, the number of deck actions that you've got this issue of law between the lien, which needs to be addressed, as well as the statute that authorizes the hospital to file or grants them their lien, the statute itself, which expressly under the deck action is authorized to be construed when it affects individual rights, there's no statutory cause of action for the patient that says the patient has the right to sue or do anything about it. That's why Mr. Featherly was in a complete limbo status. What he's got this lien out there. He can't get the hospital to release it. What alternative do you have? I'm at a loss, and that question was never answered below, and I don't believe that Chapter 55 statutorily authorizes a cause of action. That's why we have, I believe, a perfect use of the declaratory judgment action. And in summary is...
Mr. Michelle, real quick, though.
Yes, Your Honor.
He could have paid the lien, correct? I mean, you're saying he's in limbo. I mean, he could have paid the amount. That would be one way to get out of it, correct? I mean, the reason he's in limbo is because he's contesting the amount. Am I right in that?
Correct. Yeah, I mean, that would be true on anyone who makes an improper demand. If you wanted to avoid litigation, you could just pay the improper demand. However, the deck action, I believe, is perfectly tied to this specific issue to resolve this dispute. And
the enforcement mechanism is actually that your release isn't any good until you either pay or you get the hospital to sign off on the settlement agreement.
Correct.
And in this instance, you didn't get the hospital to sign off on the settlement agreement.
We did not.
And you didn't pay.
Correct.
So under 55007, the release that you granted to Ms. Applebaum is 6 years later or 5 years later. It's ineffective at this point in time, but your agreement agrees to indemnify them for any attempt on the part of the hospital to enforce the lien against them. So I'm jumping to the admissibility issues with regard to ratification. The language used was incurred in the settlement agreement. The language used with regard to the interrogatories was incurred. The exact amount, the $24,000 and change, was identified as being incurred. Your clients swore that in fact, was what was incurred. Incurred is a specialized term because we now have paid or incurred is what the actual damage is that for medical expenses. And in fact, his original petition specifically said that I want damages for reasonable and necessary expenses, and these are the ones that I've quote unquote incurred. So you have a statement in the pleading that the $24,000 was reasonable and necessary and incurred. You have sworn testimony with regard to the interrogatory that this was what was actually incurred. Okay, you have just offhand. Interrogatory 20, you're specifically asked if there is a lien in existence 2 years after it became existing, and you don't identify it, or he doesn't identify it, okay? But then we go on and to the disclosures and the same exact information. And then when you finally wrap it all up in a bow, in the place where you're supposed to, the only place the hospital has any leverage whatsoever, you say, we agree to pay any lien that's existing that's been incurred. So all of it ties back to what your client said, this is what my cause of action is. The lien is against the cause of action for the amount in the invoices, okay? So why wasn't that something that should have been considered by the jury under the circumstances?
I think Judge Rabel had it exactly right, Your Honor. Incurred. What was Stephen Featherly supposed to do when he has a sworn affidavit by the hospital, a lien filed of record, saying, swearing, that's what you owe to me? He is not a judge. He's not a jury who can say, you know what, I'm going to pretend, even though I dispute it, I'm going to pretend that the hospital's not got a sworn affidavit and a lien filed of record against me and say, you know what, that is correct. That's
what's the distinction between the settlement here and had the jury found $24,000 as reasonable and necessary, incurred, and entered a judgment in favor of your client? Would you then be able to turn back and say, oh, no, that's not what was actually incurred? We only incurred the $13,000. What's the distinction here?
I think there's a huge distinction. One is they forwarded on the sworn affidavit of the hospital. He would have been penalized if he had not disclosed that sworn amount.
That's not mere forwarding. He got that affidavit to prove up damages. That's an 18001 affidavit.
It is. It is an affidavit.
I don't want to have to bring the guy down here to prove it during trial.
Exactly. However, if you're trying to forward to the opposing party what is alleged by the debt out there, you're not going to say, yeah, I'm going to agree that that's the amount. But that's the amount that they're saying is due. He would have been in violation of not forwarding that on to them.
But he was only entitled to whatever was incurred, okay? And Haygood made it absolutely clear that incurred is not just whatever, what's the word, the something charges, supercharges or whatever it is, okay? That if, in fact, there's any credits or anything like that, why could he not have used the original invoice that said he got an uninsured discount credit?
Well, he didn't, and the hospital never offered that. Remember, if you look back in the record, the hospital made the demand for the $24,000. Before they came on board, they were going to temporarily offer a discount, and then it was gone, and they wanted the full amount. Today, they still want the full $24,000.
Well, they have a lien, whatever the amount is, but they have a lien on that $500,000 settlement. And that lien is still there, and it hasn't been paid, and the release that you've given to Ms. Applebaum is about as worth as much as what the signature's worth, which is nothing right now.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, because we have a declaratory judgment declaring a part of the lien invalid, and if Ms. Applebaum ever gets indemnified, our obligation is to indemnify and hold harmless. So that's a separate cause of action by Mr. Featherly potentially.
But that's not contemplated by the statute. The statute says it's only enforceable if it's paid or if the hospital is brought in on the agreement.
Correct.
Period. It doesn't say anything about, well, we'll indemnify, et cetera, down the line.
Okay? I believe that's a separate and independent action with what's before this court and before here today on under the amount of the lien, which
Mr. Michelle,
yes.
Real quick. I think you heard Mr. Gober say that Mr. Featherly got $200,000 out of the $500,000. Is that correct? And if so, how did y'all get to that number? Who was paid?
Oh, sure. This was in a completely separate settlement between the driver and Mr. Featherly in a lawsuit that was litigated arising from his personal injury.
Yeah.
Damages.
Sure.
And there's no correlation between the amount of the settlement and what was offered to pay. It's not like they said, oh, we're paying you $24,000 in reasonable medical expenses. He has a traumatic brain injury, okay, that was suffered. He had no recollection of being taken to the hospital, being at the hospital, and to correlate the two, when they are approached and asked for these expenses to not disclose under the attorney's obligation to disclose the claim by the hospital, which is not just a claim, it's a sworn pleading, he would be required by law to disclose that, which he did. And I want to dovetail that into their claim that says 55.004 is titled the amount of the lien. And under B, it says a hospital lien described by section 55.002, small a, is for the amount of the hospital's charges. Justice Birdwell, that's the lien amount for their charge. Not that they're right, not that they're wrong, but that's what the lien amount is. It's for $24,000
well,
based on their charges.
Well, in the recent mandamus action up at the Supreme Court, you had some Amici arguing that because the only thing that reasonable and regulated regular rates qualifies is the phrase other services, that doesn't actually apply to charges. The Supreme Court didn't go there because it was not actually argued by the relator in the case. Okay, and that has not been argued here either.
Right.
Okay, this case was tried based upon reasonable and regular rates applying under the circumstances.
Correct.
But that's out there with regard to this particular wonderfully composed legislative statute. So
I was going to say the answer to me, Your Honor, is and you may, I think you may have alluded to it during the opening argument, is the real cure, if the legislature wants to come in and make it clear and give them a private cause of action to deal with these, that's the real remedy, is it, I guess it's guaranteed employment for all of us when we have unclear statutes, but they clearly could have articulated a much better statute on this.
Let me get to a couple of things. First, this argument that because he was not admitted,
yes,
therefore, the lien doesn't attach.
Correct.
How is that a argument consistent with the fact that 55004 defines emergency medical services and allows the hospital to attach to its own lien the emergency room services provided by a physician in the hospital? Okay. So somehow emergency medical services under G, that's a separate and distinct thing, and it refers specifically back to Section 773.003 of the Texas Health and Safety Code, okay? You look at that statute, that's all about EMS services, that's
right.
All about transfer, that's all about services provided pre-hospital, okay? So those guys get a lien, okay? You get to the hospital, and the physician in the ER gets a lien, and in fact, the hospital can enforce that. But your position with regard to admit is that until they're actually admitted to the hospital, nothing that's done by the nurses or the techs or anybody with regard to actually providing care in the ER actually is covered under the hospital lien statute.
That would be my textualist reading of the statute. That's exactly what it says. We also disagree about the recent enactment under Section 55.0015, which then goes on to define, right, for
right.
The first time what admitted is. Of course, from our position, the reason why is brings up that very reason, Justice Birdwell, and they give it a very expansive definition of admitted. And I think clearly the reason was to remove or to clarify or to change that particular meaning of the word admitted.
Well, the reason I brought this up is subsection C of 55.004 specifically refers to the physician's lien, okay, his reasonable and necessary charges, quote, for emergency hospital care services, okay, which is distinct from emergency medical services under the Health and Safety Code. So it's specifically talking about providing emergency care in a hospital context that not only does the physician have the ability to enforce the lien, but the hospital can enforce it for him, but somehow that doesn't include any hospital care other than his care.
My first answer is if following, A, they've never raised this argument before. I know the court is raising it on its own. They've never raised this argument. Second, that's what the text says. Once again, the legislature has come in and interlineated. It's done its legislative job, enacting legislation. in 55.0015, believing that there needed to be an definition of admitted. If they wanted to, the legislature could, if it's a perceived gap by the court, the legislature is the body to come in and statutorily correct it.
Do you remember what page that definition is in your brief?
Ours?
Yes.
What page number?
Yeah. Excuse me.
If you can't access it super fast, don't worry about it.
But. Sure. We cite it. Uh, 14 and 17.
Thank you.
Going back to my questions earlier, what do we look at in terms of deciding whether your claim for recovery of attorney's fees is fair and equitable under the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act?
I noticed that, Your Honor. I did not see them detail the normal factors that we normally have in both sides of the appellate briefs. But in its discretion of equitable and fair, the trial court, of course, is granted with the discretion. I think the court heard quite a bit of testimony and heard argument at the post-verdict hearing on attorney's fees about the offers of settlement, the efforts to try to resolve this matter, the efforts of the amount of the attorney's fees the hospital incurred at the time was over $115,000 on an one time they had offered $13,000 and then took it back and offered $24,000 and never budged off the $24,000. The court is able to look at the factors of the conduct of the litigation. Judge Rabel took a pretty good considered hands-on approach at looking at the actions that happened down below and what was happening and the efforts to try to get this resolved. Clearly, Judge Rabel agreed that Mr. Featherly didn't have another alternative other than to file a request for a declaratory judgment action. And when the amount, I will cite that in their affidavits going into resisting motions for summary judgment at 1 CR74, Your Honor, Scott Azun, the senior VP for the hospital, gave multiple affidavits saying, I've reviewed the medical billings attached to the hospital lien for Mr. Stephen Featherly for medical services rendered to him on or about March 13th, 2014. A copy of the lien, and the relevant billing is attached as Exhibit A-1. He says that those are the correct and reasonable charges. Also, he testified at trial at page 78 on volume 5 that he looked over the affidavit of expenses, saying the $24,682 was a reasonable regular rate. Post-trial, they've taken that as well. And in defendant's exhibit number 4 is the sworn affidavit of the billing record saying that the $24,682 was the correct amount. I think Judge Rabel was allowed to take all those factors, including the jury verdict that showed that a substantially lesser amount than what they were claiming, are factors that you look to see what is equitable and just, and also seeing how, of course, we contend we prevailed. I believe Judge Rabel believed we prevailed and entered judgment on those factors. I noticed neither side provided the court much guideline on those factors on equitable and just. However, we don't believe, since the other side didn't submit the briefing, that would not show an abuse of discretion on Judge Rabel's decision-making.
Okay. Counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, Your Honors, going back to Justice Wallach's question about the factors you take into account, one of the primary factors is the extent to which the party you're awarding fees prevailed. And they pled the specific amount of $7,372 as reasonable and necessary in the pleading, period. That's the reasonable and regular. Declare the lien invalid because it's one penny more than that. That was the position that they took throughout the course of the litigation. If it's one penny more than what our California expert says, then your lien is void. The court disagreed with that and kind of engaged in that.
Well, given Garner came down in 59 and the hospital lien statute's been amended numerous times since then, the last being in 2019, as you pointed out, with regard to 0015. And for whatever reason, the legislature has not seen fit to say, well, we either agree or disagree with Garner that a deck action is an appropriate means by which to either seek the total invalidation of the lien or the partial invalidation of the lien. Basically, if we don't buy your $841 is in the lien distinction, that's been the means by which patients have always seemed to challenge under the circumstances in a deck action. So why shouldn't we just simply follow that and think that the legislature thinks that's perfectly fine because they've amended the statute many times since then?
Well, the way I read Garner is that the amount was in the lien. It's right there in the first couple of paragraphs. However, if that wasn't the case, let's assume that wasn't the case, then you can call it a deck action. But if the substantive law from which all the parties' rights flow does not provide for the recovery of attorney's fees, you can't get the attorney's fees, even if the Declaratory Judgment Act is the appropriate vehicle to have that matter adjudicated. I mean, there are a number of cases, MBM Financial, the Rame case from last summer from this court, the Eaton Industries case. There's a really good quote from Justice Calvert, and you can never go wrong with a Justice Calvert quote in the MBM case, in Judge Brister's opinion. Judge Calvert stated that perhaps every successful litigant should be permitted to recover his attorney's fees from the opposite party, but whether that policy would be wise is for the legislature, not the courts, to decide. Apparently, the legislature has not thought it wise. That's the Van Zandt versus Fort Worth Press case.
If I could get back to your prevailing party argument, okay, you say they asked for $7,000 some odd as the reasonable and necessary. Well, you asked for $24,000 some odd as a reasonable and fair and reasonable rate. The jury split the difference. Okay, so who's the prevailing party? Both or neither?
I think you could argue under 37.009 it wouldn't be equitable to award the fees to either party. In our case, we were bringing it under Chapter 38. We never asked for our fees under Chapter 37. We believe in taking a consistent
approach.
Right,
I'm not talking about your fees, but I'm talking about your argument earlier about they weren't the prevailing party, you were, so therefore it's not equitable and just.
Well, they weren't the prevailing party because the lien is not void, which is what they always ask to have it declared, and they weren't the prevailing party because the jury didn't award them out that they specifically pled in their pleading.
But they did get at least a penny more, correct?
They did get just a penny more, and we never pled a specific amount. We just answered with a general denial. The court or the judge and the jury awarded the amount of the cash discount, which we had previously sent. And getting back to, it was never the hospital's position, pay us $24,000 and that's all we'll ever take and we won't negotiate. That's not what happened. I'm not sitting there on a $13,000 cash discount bill and sticking with the 24 for purposes.
Let me ask you this. When y'all were arguing fair and just, you know, equitable and just with regard to Judge Rabel, did you include in your argument any of the information that you attempted to get into evidence concerning the interrogatories, the request for disclosure, the settlement agreement, the indemnification, or anything of that nature for him to consider with regard to whether or not it would be equitable and just to give $88,000 worth of attorney's fees under the circumstances, given the commitment that Mr. Featherly made to Ms. Applebaum and her carrier, that was in fact going to be paid?
I think her argument with the interrogatories and all the other was primarily ratification in response to the capacity argument. You've you've adopted this number, you've admitted that that's what I owe, so that ought to be. I don't know that we argued it in response, but it was certainly before the court, and he certainly could have taken that into account.
Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel.
You're out of time, real quick last question.
Sure.
Is it fair to assume that, kind of going to Justice Wallach's question, that you were there at trial, correct?
Yes, sir.
That you felt
that's a dangerous question. It's going to be a dangerous question now.
But you felt like you had prevailed after the verdict came back.
Absolutely.
At least until you got popped with the almost $90,000 in attorney's fees.
I thought I had prevailed, and between you and me and the fence post, I thought the jury thought we had prevailed. So.
All righty. Well, the case is submitted. Thank you, gentlemen.